Now, broadcasting on Radio Star Worldwide, it's time for Dr. Rademacher's Prescription for Transformation. Let's tap into your own authentic genius and live the life you desire. Join Dr. Rademacher for an enlightened conversation about our brain intelligence, our body intelligence, and our energy intelligence. And now, here's your host, Dr. Bart Rademacher.
Welcome. I'm Dr. Bart Rademacher, prescription for your transformation. Real people, real success, real conversations. I'm going to introduce right away Wendy, my producer. She's awesome. She just told me she doesn't need any restructuring of her face. And Dr. Mohamed Kudami, an incredible human being that I have the pleasure to be interviewing today. And I will share with you his gift and his talent. But let me start off with this, is that because we make bad choices in our lives, because we choose to eat the wrong things, be exposed to the wrong environments, or just have those thoughts that really don't serve us in the best possible way, you know, our body then responds. And it responds in a way that, you know, delivers all sorts of limitations, if you will, to our, you know, life. And we call those things diseases. We call those things like cancer. Yes, some people are born with congenital defects, but let's also understand that many of those at times are also the result of bad choices in life. As a parent or as a woman, perhaps, you know, exposed to different things, causing some sort of congenital deformities. But needless to say, people need help. And again, this is the purpose of this platform, really to share the insights and the tools and the resources of incredible people like today, Dr. Mohamed Kudami, that you can then make better choices. Many times people will come to me and ask me, look, you know, I made this choice. I went to this doctor. I did this thing. You know, is this the right thing? And I tell them, I wish you'd, you know, talk to me sooner, because there are other choices. And unfortunately, too often in the medical culture that we have today, because of perhaps the limitations of what people know as far as their training, then they may not necessarily give you all the choices. So that's one of the reasons for this platform. Platform really is out there to give you that information, to provide you more choices, happier people have more choices in life, and also to bring you the brilliant people like Dr. Mohamed Kudami. So thank you so much for joining me today.
Honored to be with you. Thank you for the invitation.
So you have a very special skill. And, you know, this is a skill that if I was in your profession, I'd be very excited about, because I'd be doing this, you know, side by side with you. And that is what we call robotic surgery. And so what is so special about robotic surgery? Because, you know, a lot of people think, you know, robots, well, you know, that's kind of scary. That's maybe taking my job away. But in the field of medicine, that's a very different situation. So explain to the listeners a little bit about, you know, what is this robotic surgery really all about?
You know, maybe one day robots will take our jobs away. I'm not sure about it. At this time, they need us. We're the operator. As a matter of fact, the U.S. military is the one that designed this machine. The concept was to provide service to soldiers at battlefields when the surgeons is going to be hard to find and to transfer. And as a matter of fact, they did operation from one continent on another continent, surgeon being in one continent, patient being in another continent, with secure lines, and the operation went well. So that's the beginning of new era when you can serve probably the globally everybody around, hopefully. But the robotics have enabled us to see much better. So it is magnification. At the same time, the delicate equipments that we are using enables us to do much, much more precise operation. When it comes to prostate operation, for most men, they used to lose their continence, they used to lose their erectile functioning. And in the right population, you can serve all those nerves. You can see better, you can do better cancer operation to get them rid of cancer. And guess what? Most patients will go home the following day. I operated on a bunch of patients yesterday. They all went home this morning, which is an amazing thing. They used to be in hospital for many days, need blood transfusion, have lots of pain. It's gone. So it's exciting for us, feeling that we're serving, and patients are excited about it, because now we get to see each other and hug each other instead of being worried about how much cancer is left and how we can kill it. And the patient is back to life. I am sure everybody agrees with me that having the sexual functioning back in mid-age man or even in elderly is tremendous important things for any relationship. And
right.
I'm very happy that this is not getting out of control.
So in a way, you're saving a lot of men and saving a lot of, you know, relationships, you know?
A lot, and I'm very proud of that.
Yeah, and I think that's something that sometimes, you know, we just simply, you know, don't understand or appreciate, you know, the significance of erectile dysfunction, you know, for men and in relationships, because that's just such an intimate part of any kind of relationship. You know, you'd hate not to have that. But let's go a little bit back to this whole robotic concept, because, you know, share with the listener, you know, how does that actually work? And so are you in the same room with the patient? I mean, you know, who makes the cut, you know, and the patient as well? I mean, how does that work? Just take us through a few steps, maybe over the next, you know, minute or two, as to how that would work, say, someone who had, you know, prostate cancer.
Correct. So the surgeon is usually in the room, and to save time and energy, he's the same person that gets access to patient's abdomen, which is usually where we operate on, to install the instrument needed. Then robot is going to touch those instruments, and we continue to go back to our console, which is usually located in the same room. But we have communication ways of hearing each other. And the staff, either they have a screen to see what I'm looking at, or they have their own eyeglasses, which is three-dimensional eyeglasses, so they have the three-dimensional views that I have. The technology has enabled us. Surgeon doesn't need to be in the same room. As I said, it can be in distance, but you have to make sure that the internet is secure enough that you don't lose your connection. And, you know, in real life, operating, I don't know, 10, 15 times at least a week, it's not practical that another surgeon gets access, and we don't want the nurses to get access for us because of the complexity of access at the beginning of the procedure. So yes, I'm the one who decides where I'm going to put my holes in their abdomen, which are tiny holes, usually 5 millimeter holes. And then after I'm done with the operation, if that's cancer, then I have to get it somewhere out of the body and retrieve it. And if it's not cancer, cases, which many kids and other disease in ladies, they not necessarily have cancer. So there is no organ to retrieve. You just fix the stuff inside their abdomen. Then you just close your entrance points and you get out.
So basically, what you do is you make these small incisions. You put like a scope in there, I guess, like a camera.
Right.
Correct. And then you put through different holes, you know, different instruments. And what's amazing about the instruments is that they're so fine that you can be much more precise in your surgery, correct?
Very true. And better than that, they never get tired. Guess what? They're robot. They're not going to be shaky if they didn't have lunch. They're not going to nag. They don't want to bail you. They just listen. And you say, hold it this way. They will hold it that way. It's amazing. I mean, I can't tell you how excited I am every morning that I start my day, just knowing that how many lives I'm going to reach and how many people I can help and how much I learn. I've gotten better myself by just observing what I'm doing, and the trust the patients have given me, tremendous love and support. And it's just a journey. I think it's just started. I don't think that we're anywhere close to the middle of the road, and it's so exciting.
So I'm clear as well, because I'm fascinated by this, by the way, because I think I missed my chance, you know, to do that, because we don't do that in plastic surgery. And so to direct the robot, is that by voice, is that by your fingers in certain kinds of gloves? Do you use certain buttons or you know what's that console look like?
I wish I had a picture of it to show your audience. I could have it, but it was short notice. But essentially, it's ergonomically designed machine that you sit inside. It has two different lens, so you will have the perception of three-dimensional. And then you have a bunch of buttons, and that enables you to do a bunch of different stuff at the same time you're in the abdomen. So you can, for example, tell the robot to look that way or the other way, or, you know, different instrument will be activated. So you have like five hands inside the patient's abdomen, depending on the complexity of the case you do. So you can activate arm number one and then deactivate arm number two, or lift up something with arm number three while arm number one and three are working together. It's not voice activated. It is purely joysticks that you activate and deactivate. Or you can bring ultrasound, for example, at the same time. When we do cancer operation on kidneys, many times the cancer is hiding inside the kidney. So from the surface, you don't see anything. It's not tip of iceberg or anything. So ultrasound helps you find it. In the past, we used to sacrifice the whole kidney.
Wow.
And these patients, usually when they get older, they will have high blood pressure, diabetes, and their life will be shortened because of loss of the functional organ that they unfortunately missed. But now with all these technologies, which is amazing, I mean, amazing, and you can just see the cancer like day and night. You can see your margin. You can just cut it out and you can close the defect. And the whole thing may take about an hour and a half. Patient goes home the following day. No biggest scar, no big incision, no transfusion needed. Of course, things can go wrong any day. Thanks God that there's not many days in our lives so far. But overall, to me as a physician, this was dream come true once in the past, that you can do such a complex operation and patient just leaves hospital the following day. Many times we have to argue with them. You're not supposed to go back to work. They want to go back to work 3 days later, 4 days later. So, I mean, that's a miracle.
Yeah, I remember back when I started my training, you know, we would admit people like a week beforehand and, you know, get all the prep work and, you know, everything else, and then get the lab work and clean out the bowels, and then we'd do the surgery, and then they would stay for another 2 weeks. You know, I was introduced in that time when laparoscopic surgery first came on board. That was actually in my first year of surgery. And I was absolutely fascinated with it. You know, growing up, I played my version of Nintendo games, which was just Pac-Man, pretty much. That was all that we had then. But I you know, went like a fish to water in when we started using endoscopic surgeries. And I, in my very first year, in fact, I was only a resident in my second month. I was doing laparoscopic surgery, which is really quite unheard of. You know, in most residency programs, you have to wait till your third or fourth year before you get to do that. But I was taking out gallbladders in 30 minutes. And awesome. Nowadays, even surgeons, there are many surgeons that their average time is also 30 minutes. I mean, I think the best times probably nowadays is probably about 11, you know, taking out a non-inflamed gallbladder. But how amazing, how cool is that? How much of an honor it is, in the sense of privilege it is for people like yourself and myself to be operating and changing people's lives so dramatically. I mean, you change people's lives in a much different way than I do, but still the impact is pretty profound. So what's it like for you, you know, when you're in that consult? Let me ask this question. Let me finish the question, because there's two parts to this. You know, what was it like before when you didn't have the robots, you know, and has that feeling changed now that you use robots?
So let me answer that in two parts. First of all, congratulations to you to do such an operation in 30 minutes laparoscopically. Those days it used to be 2 hours. I remember that. Learning curve has been really, really sharp. So you're amazing, as I guess. But to answer you, you know, laparoscopy is actually quite more difficult than robotics. Many open surgeons could not be robotic surgeons because of the complexity of laparoscopic surgeon because of complexity of laparoscopy. But robotics is such an innocent device that is so forgiving. If you have shaking tremors, you can make the robot to eliminate it. You can tell the robot that if the hand has like a little bit shake, don't take it, don't listen to me, and it won't have any tremor. So my point is, robotics is much, much easier than laparoscopy. And congratulations to those kids who have been playing with those games. Studies have shown that there are, by nature, the best robotic surgeons. So whoever has done those internet games or TV games, not necessarily things bad comes out of it. Some of them are really, really good laparoscopic or robotic surgeons. Mm. In the past, we would have much more fatigue to do such an operation with laparoscopy. Shoulders would get tired. I couldn't have done like 3 prostates in one day. After the second one, I would be exhausted. And, you know, it's a little bit difficult to see because the camera of robotics is much better view because of 3-dimensional view we have. Laparoscopy is 2-dimensional view. So it's like you're looking at the TV and you don't have a perception of depth, which is huge. For example, you're talking about gallbladder operation. There is fluorescent studies that robot enables us. You click a button and you inject some of the, you know, fluorescent, and within 30 seconds, it shows you exactly where the vessels are. Guess what? The game is over. That's all that's difficult in gallbladder operation. You need to know where's the artery. And all of a sudden, it's like imagination. It comes true. It shows you the artery and the branch of artery. No brainer. So that's why the time is down to 11 minutes now, because it just takes 5-6 minutes to put the ports in there and 30 seconds to give that material, and then game is over. Really, game is over. Two clips and amazing, isn't that? Somebody tells you, where is the vessel behind this story? I don't know. It's like there is a leak behind the wall, and all of a sudden, within 5 seconds, it shows you exactly where the leak is. If you're a plumber, what's your sensation? What's your excitement? Amazing, right?
Absolutely. And for the listeners, just to appreciate the fact that, you know, whenever we're operating, you know, it's a very, how should I put it, complex process insofar as that, you know, you have to manage a lot of different anatomical parts. And in particular, you know, blood vessels and nerves. And the most important thing whenever we're performing surgery is we want to do no harm. And it's quite easy, you know, to, you know, tear out a blood vessel or nerve and cause all sorts of problems. And so that's one of the biggest things and challenges in any kind of surgery, you know, that we don't, you know, cut into anything that we shouldn't cut into. Otherwise, it would be a simple process.
Correct. So, for example, for kidney cancer, we used to shut down the whole flow of the kidney, the blood flow, for whatever minute that it takes, usually 30 minutes max. But the kidney would suffocate for 30 minutes because there's so many vessels going to this mass. Now, with this technology, you essentially go to branch of artery, and where you think the artery is feeding the cancer, you just block that, and you test it by the same fluorescent. If the tumor doesn't light up, you're fine. Rest of the kidney has blood supply while you're operating on the disease part.
Amazing.
Bingo. I know.
So typically in the past, when you were performing these surgeries, you'd always have an assistant, potentially another surgeon. When you're managing the robotic arms, is it just you, or do you also have an assistant supporting?
I have an assistant at the bedside that does suctioning and, you know, putting instruments in and out the robot, because it has to still stay sterile. But it's usually a nurse. And I have amazing nurses who are really, really educated and as motivated as we are to serve the patient. So it's a good team. We're all proud of what we're doing.
But it's just you operating all the robotic arms?
Correct.
Wow. Okay. Because do you have a question?
I do have a question. My question is, once they actually built the robotic arms, how long or how many years did it take for you to study to feel proficient enough to start doing surgeries on people?
That was my question.
That's it. Any surgery on its own has a learning curve, depending on what the difficulty of case is. So not necessarily every robotic surgeon does every robotic case is available, because some of them may be more complex to some. Let's put it this way. Many urologists have learned how to do robotic prostatectomy, but not many perform robotic cystectomy or partial nephrectomy yet, because the complexity may be different and their comfort zone may not be there. Roughly, they have said that about 100 cases of robotics is enough for you to feel comfortable to run the show. I think that was what I heard the last time. Now, obviously, it is too generalized. There are people who are very talented, and they may see one and start doing one. And there are people who are still not there. Like, what?
So just for the listeners, nephrectomy, that's what?
Partial nephrectomy.
Yeah, but what is that?
So you have cancer that has...
The listeners don't know that.
So you have cancer that grows into kidney, and the kidney has a problem. The central part of kidney has whole blood supply that comes to kidney and feeds all areas of the kidney. So the majority of kidneys, if the cancer grows in the center part, is like choke point. You have to find a way, it's like laser beams. You have to find a way to deactivate the material in between without crossing over the laser beams, because if you do, then rest of the kidney is useless. And that's why it's such a complex operation. If it's on the poles, which is like corners of the kidney, yeah, I mean, that's not such a big deal. But when it's hiding inside the kidney and it's in the center of the kidney, then that is really challenging to get that jewel out without any of the laser beams goes off.
So what percentage of those cases with the cancer in the middle are actually operable? I mean, are successfully operable, would you say, in general?
Yeah, it's depending, again, on your surgeon's skills.
I know that. But, I mean, if you do a nationwide, you know, survey, you know, what's the expectation? What's the appropriate number, if you will, if you were even the best surgeon?
I think it's about 90%.
Wow.
In the right hands, remember that. Surgeons all around the country that are performing amazing operations, but not necessarily patients know about them. And many of them will stop at this first stop, unfortunately, where they're told that this is not something salvageable and they just give it up.
And so this is something that I'd like to stop you there for a moment. This is something that I want people to understand, is that because of all this modern technology and an incredible skill set and talent that you have and others like you have, that cases that were previously inoperable, or rather cases where the entire kidney, which is which is called nephrectomy, was to be removed. And so now people have more options. Because here's the thing, and this happens way too often, that patients aren't properly educated, is that there are consequences to not only all the bad choices you made to have this cancer, but also to have the kind of surgeries that people do afterwards, including chemotherapy, things like that. And one of my personal missions and passion, if you will, is helping people get the right kind of information. Ultimately, they can make their own choice, of course, but without that information, without people being honest enough to say, these are all the things. And I use that word very lightly, because nobody's really out there to really mislead anyone, in my opinion. I think most doctors are out there really wanting to help, otherwise they wouldn't be doing what they're doing. But sometimes, just because of the constraints of the environment, of situations, of whatever, you don't always have the opportunity to get all the information. And so the purpose, again, of this platform is really for people to appreciate, wow, you've got this condition and there are other choices. And so it's incumbent on everyone to really start doing the research and finding people like you, which is why I'm happy to be, talking to you today, because when people can find out, what you can do versus what someone else can't, your whole life can be very, very different.
You pinned it well. In any field of life, I think people nowadays have to do better search, because the choices are so different and available compared to past, and competition also makes it easier to just stop at the first shop. I think this is your job to make sure that you've done appropriate research and you have chosen the right personality and right skill sets. You have to do your homework too, absolutely.
So one thing, before we go into some specific areas of urology, I'd like to talk a little bit about your journey, because you're not unlike myself. I came from a different country, and I came to this country, in fact, many years after I was here when I was younger, really because I knew that I could do so much more if I came to this country. I could offer so much more to people, because I knew that there's inherently deep within me so many talents and gifts that if I just stayed, in my own country, those wouldn't come out. And I believe that you have the same kind of story. But what's amazing about you, when you started your postgraduate training in the United States, you had like zero pennies in your pocket. And now look at you. I mean, you're really a world-renowned, surgeon and with a passion to teach others. I mean, that's amazing. So share with us a little bit about your journey.
Well, first of all, I'm super lucky not to be born here, because it happened for me to know what is the real life out there, and then I got into heaven. So for people who have not been out of the United States, you just have no clue what the value of freedom is. And for us, people who come here and realize what the opportunities are for you to stay human, to act like a human, free human, then you realize that you have basically got to the mission of your life. So that's the best journey of my life, just to get to the United States. I was a physician. I finished my medical school. I tried to get into appropriate programs for my education, which is dream come true, since urology is extremely competitive. There's only 212 spots in the United States. And me being a foreigner, this is another example of this great country that gives you opportunity if you have dedication. So I was lucky enough to be adopted by my chairman and my dear friend, who helped me start my journey and start my researches and publications. And after that, my residency, which was 2 years of postdoc fellowship and 6 years of residency, which we worked hard. And I'm very proud of everybody who taught me who I am today. And I got the light from them, and I tried to make it better and pass it over to next one. I think that's the concept of humanity. We're sitting here talking to each other because so many talented people have made it possible for us. I remember the day I came to this country calling my mom would cost me $1.50 per minute. And look at now, we're just talking and seeing each other for free. So yes, I came and financially I was really, really, really poor. I couldn't bring any wealth with me from my hometown because of different reasons that I don't want to get into it. But eventually I was able to find my first job, which was being a busboy as a physician, because I was waiting to get my work permission to start my fellowship, right? And that had its own teaching of life for me, which I endure, and I really think made me who I am today. Then the doors of opportunity opened right after the other. And obviously me being a thirsty person to learn more and to serve more, I couldn't put it down. I remember many nights, my dear wife has been taking care of kids, and I was in operating rooms until midnight, from one hospital hopping to another hospital, do case after case, which now is paying back because I have enabled myself to learn different skills from different attendings. And I see it as a gift that God gave me. I don't think that I'm talented. I think I'm just a hardworking person. And I'm proud of being hardworking anyways. And there are so many people who helped me to become who I am today, from my elementary school teachers who taught me, through my wife who has stayed with me all these years and helped me out, to my parents, to you as a friend who's helping me to become a better person. All this group of people together are having mission to make me being a better person, to serve better. So I think it's part of my personality to educate others, and I take it seriously. Many times I travel in the United States sharing my experience with my colleague surgeons. Sometimes they bother to come to my operating room where I can show them how I do stuff. And sometimes we fly out of country trying to spread the word, the rest of the world, where they don't have that blessing of having technology we have here. And I start that small tree that hopefully one day will be a powerful light for the other part of the world.
That's amazing. You know, Wendy's also an example of one of those people that works hard and dreams big and has, you know, worked relentlessly to get to, you know, where you are today. And that's, you know, what's so much fun for me is that I get to meet people like you, Dr. Kadami and Wendy, you know, who I've learned so much from, because, you know, she had some kind of interesting hurdles that you had to overcome. And, you know, let me ask you, Wendy, what was your secret?
My secret to keep going?
Yeah.
Failure's not an option. If there's a door open, I will take that opportunity. I don't care what, you know, if I feel I'm prepared for it or not, I'm still going to take that opportunity, because it's those moments when you really take a chance that you learn the fastest. So yeah, just keep on taking all the opportunities and just don't stop and don't give up.
Good job.
Thank you.
I like it.
And that's probably, you know, mindset that you have as well, Dr. Kadami, right? I mean, failure is not an option when you're operating on somebody.
No, I never felt that I failed, to be honest with you. I think whatever that looked like a failure was a lesson for me. I always learned from whatever. And there have been days that something was not on the way I expected. I think years later, I learned that I'm happy that things went that way, because if it didn't, I wouldn't be where I am today. Mm-hmm. So, not necessarily I agree with failure. Even if in operating room thing doesn't go well, I think it's out of my control at times. I'm not superstitious, but to be honest with you, why 1,000 case goes well and just one for whatever reason doesn't? I don't know. I don't know that it's all me deciding how to do things. Sometimes it's the flow of energy or whatever, and I happen to be in that conduit and deliver it. But if there is a bad day, which there will be a bad day, I'm trying to learn lessons from it and move on and just know what I've done wrong, if there was any. Same decisions for everything in life, I think. You expect yourself to meet the person that you're supposed to be. That's the point. So what if I never get to the potentials I had? What if I gave myself a slack? And, you know, end of the day, you're not enjoying that lazy time, because you're questioning yourself. Was it the best day of your life? I mean, was it the best management of your day? Was it the best performance you could do this case? Many times I tell you, cases that I told patient 99%, I may not be able to save this freaking mass because it's so bad. It's so complex. It's like the kidney is 11 centimeter to 12 centimeter and the mass is 8.5 centimeter. I mean, how you can save anything, right? So I tell them, just let me try. That's all I can say. And in the operating room, there are many times I question myself, am I pushing it? Am I supposed to stop? where is the line that you say enough is enough? And guess what? You do it. And after that, not only you're proud of yourself, but also you've made another milestone. Now something else is doable. And now others are going to start doing it too, because once few people did, then others know it's doable too. So I think it's very exciting that you entertain your own uncertainty. And always it's out of your comfort zone. Always you have to push yourself somewhere that you're not comfortable with. But once you reach it, I think the joy is extremely high, incredibly high.
What do you think about that?
I think that's phenomenal. I agree. And I like the way that you stated that, you know, there's really no defined line. You need to for yourself, judge if you are pushing it or going beyond the line or not. And I like that you acknowledge that and that you know when you're pushing it. And then, you know, if you just push it just that much more, you might make this some milestone discovery that's going to help millions of people. So I like that.
Thank you.
You know, what's interesting is most people don't appreciate this part of what it is to be at the forefront of medicine and to be operating, you know, on people without really knowing what to expect. Because in any given situation, you know, as good as you are, it's not always predictable. And then to have the wherewithal, if you will, to just be able to walk into this, you know, with a certainty and of your competence and your talents and your gift, in the knowledge that you are doing your absolute best, you're committed to doing the best of the best, and then getting phenomenal results. I mean, it's not easy being a surgeon, and it's interesting how people are so flippant about those cases that go wrong. And, you know, clearly, if someone is not choosing to be totally focused and doing the right thing in surgery, that's one thing. You know, I don't think there are many people out there that are like that. Are there people that are much better than others? Yes, of course. And you are probably in the top 10%. I mean, that's my guess. Maybe you're in the top 1%. I don't know. But the truth is that, you know, not everyone is going to be as good as you are. Everyone is trying just as hard to do the best that they can. And so it surprises me, you know, when too often, you know, when a case does go wrong, that the society just, you know, blames you. And I would like to go back to these people and say, and again, this is not a political platform, by the way, but, you know, what was your responsibility in getting sick in the first place, right? You know, who got sick here? I didn't cause your illness. And so I think it's very brave and courageous of you to have this kind of mindset that you have. Because here's also truth that I know. A lot of surgeons out there play it small, play it careful. And by doing so, you know, they're not becoming the best version of themselves, like, you know, you just said you want to be. Correct. Because that best version of everyone can make this world so much of a better place. But yeah, some people are being too cautious, and a lot of people miss out. And so I think it's amazing what you do then, is you're pushing that envelope and pushing it in such a manner, in such a respectful and mindful manner, not recklessly, because I know there's guys out there that are very reckless. And so I have tremendous, you know, respect and faith in what it is that you do, and I'm really glad we're having this conversation today.
Thank you. I'm honored. I have to give credit to my patients who feel your sincerity and feel that you really want to do whatever you can to serve them. Because there are times that you can save something, or you just come out and say, it didn't go the way I wanted it to go. But they understand it. You know, I have not been sued ever. I think part of it is not that I never had a bad outcome. It's just you're telling your patient, I did whatever I could. And they read your lines. They read that you really did whatever you could. And if they have done their homework and know that you're not somebody out there who's just, as you mentioned, recklessly jumping here and there, then they understand that whoever else was doing the case, probably they would have the same outcome. As you said, you know, we're not the one who made this disease. And sometimes the call is made late. I mean, that's precisely for mental health. They need to know their prostate health. Unfortunately, there is confusing information out there. And I was just talking to my partner. Within the last week, I operated on 4 patients on prostate that all 4 of them had seriously advanced disease. Because now the men are thinking that there is no need for PSA measurement. I take the moment here to reach out to men and remind them that you're the first one to be responsible for your health. You have to demand, not necessarily leaving it to system who can fail would be appropriate, because whose life is online? And once you learn that the disease is a spread to your body, your anger, disappointment, I don't know, whatever you get, depression, won't get you anywhere. It's too late. So please start searching. Find out as a man what screening tests you need to have. Find the right physician who cares about you. Spend enough time with you, and it's not hopping from one room to other room. And hopefully you find the right personality. Physicians, as Dr. Rademacher mentioned, we are good humans. I think we're all here to serve. There are exceptions in any profession, including medicine. Physicians probably are the first to criticize themselves for their loss. And I have seen that firsthand from the time I was an intern to resident to see what happens to my attending, how devastated he becomes when the patient is not salvaged appropriately. And I have been witness their tears and sometimes disappointment, despite that patients won't ever see that. It looks like they're heart rock, they're emotionless. It's not. It's like their day is over. They're broken. So you do everything possible in the hands of a human not to reach to the point that you put your patient down. The person who trusted you to give kiss to their loved ones for the last time to sleep, not knowing if they're going to wake up from the surgery or not. So that's a tremendous amount of privilege that they give us as surgeons to put them to sleep, which may be their final sleep. And definitely I can tell you that there is probably nobody out there who intentionally wants to harm anybody to get any financial benefits out of it. Yet I haven't seen anybody around me, at least all these years, from overseas to here to different state that I have been. So unfortunately, things go wrong because people underestimate their power. They don't know when they're supposed to stop. They haven't been exposed to complexity of some cases, so they underestimate it. It's all physicians' fault. I'm not defending it. But to some extent, it is the patient's responsibility to choose the best.
No, you're absolutely right. And you know, in some of the conversations I've had with other surgeons over the years, you know, when we talk about complicated cases or cases that didn't turn out well, you know, most of them are just absolutely devastated. And I'm talking about the surgeons, not the patients.
Yeah, the patient.
And, you know, and I think, again, I think you're absolutely right. Most people don't appreciate this part. And getting a lawsuit, for example, it's not so much, you know, the lawsuit in of itself, but it's the faith in yourself as a surgeon. You know, here's an institution, if you will, that's telling you that you're a bad person, that you did wrong. And when nothing is further from the truth, bad things happen. That's unfortunate. And I think it's important here to share a statistic that I'm not so sure everyone's going to quite understand, but it's one that I understood in when I was a resident in general surgery. And, you know, like you, I did many, many years of training. I did a total of 17 years of training, 9 of which were surgical. And I feel very blessed, you know, that I came also from somewhat humble, you know, beginnings as well, and appreciating, you know, differences. I feel more American today than I think some Americans do, even though I was never born in this country. But the point that I'm getting at, you know, is really appreciating that there is so much that really has to go into this. And I just lost my train of thought there. You know, we put so much energy, you know, into just getting it right. And when it just doesn't happen, oh, wait, that's what it was, the statistic. So during residency, see, my mind goes all over. You know, Wendy, you're a distraction. Your face is so beautiful. You know, every time I look at your face, it's just like, aw, there's this beautiful woman there.
I could turn off my camera if you want.
No, I don't do that because you compensate for our ugly looks. So and he's uglier than I am. No, I'm just kidding. But the statistic that I was bringing up is you know, when we're doing diagnosing appendicitis, and you might relate to this as well, Mo, is that the accuracy rate of diagnosing appendicitis should be 90%. So what does that mean? That means that in 10% of the cases, you take someone to the operating room and they didn't have appendicitis. And so, and that's an important number. And then people think, well, 10 people, you know, didn't need an operation. No, it's just that because we're more careful with that, that means if we were always 100% accurate in our diagnosis, once we took someone to the operating room, that would mean that we would miss a whole bunch of people, you know, with appendicitis. And so we have to understand that there's a certain margin of error, you know, with any medical procedure. I mean, this is not an absolute strict science. It's not always 100% clear. And so it's the same thing when we're operating out there. I mean, we come across many different situations that are just totally unpredictable. And we always just simply do the best that we can. And as surgeons, and I can speak for you as well, I'm sure, as we take full responsibility, we own the results that we get, the good, the bad, and the indifferent ones. Because we are so passionate. And this is one of the things that I really respect about you. And let me ask you this, Wendy. I mean, I'm putting you here in the spot because you're going to have to give your opinion of Mo here. Is, you know, he seems like, he doesn't look like a doctor, does he?
He actually is very humbled like one. So that's always a good thing, right? Wait, but necessarily what does a doctor look like? I mean, I grew up watching Doogie Howser, MD. So who am I to judge, right?
Yeah, but it doesn't come across as your typical doctor. And some people will laugh at my next comment. And because I was the same thing. I mean, most of the time, you know, when I would go to the hospitals, I mean, I was just really friendly. I was very approachable, you know, and people, I would joke with my patients and they'd always have a fun time with me. And they always loved me. And even though I was there less time with them than most of the other internists. But oftentimes, and I would say, you know, the best compliment that I would get was that people thought I was a nurse. Because I was so nice.
Really?
Loving. Yeah, nurses are giving, loving unconditionally without financial substitute. That's why people love them the most. And definitely I can see the true passionate human being love through our nurses, many, many of them. Mm-hmm. The type of job they do is amazing. The hours of work they do is amazing. The sacrifice they do is unbelievable. But you're right. I mean, I feel first I'm supposed to be a human. Mm-hmm. And the humans don't recognize title. It's just loving each other. That's, I think, what we're meant to be. I love my environment. So from the moment I enter from the cafe to see the beautiful chef and whoever is serving us, the janitors of hospital to nurses to patients to doctors to colleagues, it's all the same. I mean, many times you're probably more comfortable with the janitor than you are with your colleagues sometimes because they're more of easygoing human. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I agree with you. I don't see myself as like the hat of surgeon when I enter the hospital. It's just like another human trying to reach another human. And guess what? Many times I receive from my patient. That's the point. It's not financial substitute necessarily. Many of the times, the warm look you get back from them or shake hand you get from them or the moment of silence that you have when they say thank you for what you've done to them, that is a whole lot more than the financial privilege that you have to charge them. So,
let me ask this. When did you know that you wanted to become a doctor? At what age?
Well, many years ago, I happened to be in a country that we had war in it. And as part of high school I did some of the public duty service. So I was in hospital where they would bring all this disease or people who've been bombarded. And I felt my heart is going out to try to salvage as many as I could. It's like a person who's devastated trying to reach out as many as I could. I learned that I have a passion for that. And then, so that was part of when I learned that I would like to serve medically, because you can help in whatever clothes you have. As a teacher, you do amazing job. We all know what teachers are doing for us. As a journalist, as a broadcaster, you can shed light to the life of so many millions of innocents. You name it, I can go on and on and on. But I felt by giving medical care, I feel satisfied myself. And that's very important because there is not a single day that I come home and I said, darn it, I wish I wasn't doing this job. If I was born 10 more times, that is the way I would like to proceed. it makes me feel better about myself. And then, obviously, because I am happy, then I can serve better. And I get it from my patients. They always call me, like, happy doctors. Just to say, you're so happy all the time. So, because you are in my life. That's my answer. That's why I'm happy. So I think that has worked well. I still feel like by giving, I'm receiving more than giving. I always have received more from my patients than I have given them, and I mean it.
That's awesome. That's awesome. What do you think, Wendy?
I'm impressed. Seriously impressed. That's wonderful. And, you know, it does make a difference when doctors are more personable. You know, so many times you go to see a doctor and you see the nurses and they are wonderful. They're loving, they're caring. Then you meet the doctor and he doesn't look you in the eye. He's too busy looking at your charts. They'll say a couple things and then they'll leave. And so I like that you two do not go by that school of thought, that you actually take the time to get to know your patients and really care and show warmth and loving. And I love that.
You know, we all try. Sometimes just sitting at the bed for 2 minutes may make them feel closer to you or hold their hands compared to standing and talking to them. Not necessarily, it may be more time. It is the way you just approach them. Mm-hmm. And you let them know that you're accessible and you're touchable and you're available for them. Because the reality of medicine is, and I have to be fair to my colleagues, you know, the reimbursement is cutting every day. And the office overhead is getting worse. And the physicians are stretching themselves so horribly. People don't know how much they are financially suffering. To them, it looks like that's part of the society that makes lots of money. The majority are not, actually. The majority are struggling to keep, you know, their offices open. And I know that. I see that the first hand, specifically in popular crowded states. So that's not the point of us becoming a physician. We all know that we could invest this time that we have done with this talent that God gave us and the hardworking and intention on anything, and we could be the best of that job for sure. So we're in this business, as Dr. Radmega said, for a reason. And we're not forgetting it. But at the same time, I wouldn't expect patients to trust us the first place by looking at us. Now, we're human too. Remember, we all have very psychotic issues in society, some of them between physicians. Some physicians are diseased. Mm-hmm. Some are smart people, but not personable, or they have mental issues too. So that's another deal. That's my point. You have to find the right person that you feel comfortable telling them. The other thing urologists do, by the way, you know, Bart, is sexual dissatisfaction. It's amazing how many of the ladies out there are dissatisfied with their sexual partners. And it's kind of a suspicious, fishy land for most of the ladies to be vocal about it. So they have to feel that this guy is there to help me and he really wants to fix the problem. So I have the privilege of fixing many couples, you know, men and women. And I can't tell you how many letters sometimes I get on Valentine's Day from the patients who now at age 70, they're saying that they have the best relationship of their lives. Wow. And man, I love that. I mean, it's not about cancer, but it's not any less than cancer. What's the point of being alive and not knowing what the love means? Or, you know, I think it's important to find the right personality that you're feeling comfortable, secure enough to open up your secrets and let them know that you need help.
I think you said something very important, and that is simply this, is that, you know, everything in life is really about relationships, you know, whether it's a doctor or somebody else. And if we can just spend a little more time just exploring that opportunity to develop these relationships and then find that place of trust and loyalty and things like that. And it's particularly relevant in the field of medicine, because when you look at the old doctors from, you know, way back when, you know, they were like their personal friends. And many times, you know, people didn't have money and they, you know, bring their chickens or their, you know, eggs or, you know, food. Or in fact, in my particular case, I had one patient bring in shrimp, and he was like a shrimper, which is an interesting profession, by the way. And he was so nice one day when he came to the office, and he apologized. He apologized and said, look, you know, I'm coming in bare feet. And the reason he came in bare feet was because his boots stank so much of shrimp that, you know, he's just being respectful. And this was a cosmetic surgery office as well. So not only was I doing reconstructive work and traumatic injuries, that was very early on in my career as a plastic reconstructive regenerative surgeon, you know, I was doing a lot of, you know, tendon repairs and, you know, hand and feet injuries. And but what was interesting, what he didn't realize, is that, you know, whilst he was, you know, sitting in the lobby, you know, with all these other ladies and men, and they're going very expensive cosmetic surgery, and he's, you know, coming in to see me to get checked for his wounds. I think he had some sort of nail stuck in his foot, and we had to take it out. What he didn't realize was that he stank as much as his boots. So taking off his boots didn't make a difference. And so it was a very, I don't know if you've ever been around people who are shrimpers, but it's a very potent smell. I mean, it's quite intoxicating. It's tough to manage. At least I found it was. But you know what? He was just a regular guy. He was just trying to be as respectful as possible. And but the real thing that's important for people to realize, and you hit a point, you know, these doctors out there are really trying very, very hard. And the problem with our society and medical care today is it's becoming even more difficult to be the best physician that they can be. Not only because the fact that reimbursement is so much less than it used to be, but also the regulations and all the things that you have to go through. And, you know, at one point I was spending half my time just doing paperwork and not doing the stuff that I really love to do. And that's wrong. It's unfortunate because, you know, for many surgeons and our physicians, if you will, not unlike my case, is I trained for 17 years. I mean, I gave up my life in essence for 17 years. And at the age of, 37 or something, then I started practicing. And it's like, wow, you know, now I can start beginning to live a life. And most people think, you know, that, you know, physicians, they're very rich, they have a lot of money, they can do all the things they want in the world. And it's not true anymore. I know that there are managers of car wash places or plumbers that earn more money than the doctors. And to me, that doesn't make any sense. And the idea that the high cost of medicine today is because of the doctors is so untrue. I mean, the cost of the physicians today is actually less than 10%. And so when people begin just to realize and begin to respect.
2%. You know, 2%. What? Cost of physician is 2%.
Oh, is that right?
98% is administration, which has grown significantly. It's exactly what you're talking about. 2% is the doctor's fee.
Yeah, and she's agreeing. She's giving us, you know, 2 minutes as well. So, you know, what's great, though, is that you've chosen to proceed. You've chosen to move forward. You've chosen, like myself, I do stem cell surgeries in different countries as well, because that's the forefront of medicine. That's where we're going to find many solutions to previously, you know, conditions that didn't have a solution, that people were, you know, doomed to a very miserable or short life ahead because we did not have those resources. And so I'm delighted to be talking to you today. Really appreciate and respect you as a human being. And you've used that word many times. And that really goes to show that anybody that's ever your patient is a very lucky person because you have heart. What?
Thank you. We have 1 minute. Let me talk about you because I owe you so much in non-field of medicine. I want your audience to know what a great person you are, how much wisdom you have. And I would like them to know that me, like anyone else, had issues in my personal life. And the person I reached out to ask his wisdom is you. And I'm very delighted that I have a big brother. That's what I call you when I talk to my wife. I have a big brother that I can pick up the phone and ask his wisdom. And I'm so blessed that destiny or universe or whatever we call it put you in my life. And I have learned so much from you, and I'm looking forward to learn more from you. And I appreciate the hard work you're doing. This is not easy to do this free work of putting information out there and trying to enlighten your audience. And that is what the whole concept of doing your homework is, and you're doing it for them. Thank you, Vindi, for being with us and giving us the feedback today, too.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it, my friend, my brother too, and my sister over there. And so with those beautiful words and looking at you as a beautiful man and you as a beautiful lady, amazing human beings, watch out for these people. I'm Dr. Bart Rademacher, prescription for your transformation. Real people, real conversations, real success. Thank you so much. Dr. Kadami, we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
for listening to Dr. Rademacher's Prescription for Transformation. Join Dr. Bart Rademacher live right here on Radio Star Worldwide each week or on demand 24/7.